Yeah, I mean, like you just said, the speaker that made the comment there, it's so true that it doesn't matter what. We're using the like thing about mowing the grass, but it's anything, isn't it? It's like thinking of oneself as a spiritual person, like the spiritual people aren't greedy. So all of a sudden, you think you're not greedy, and then someone says, "Wow, you're really greedy," and then that desensitizes them. But if you really hear it for what it is, it's just information. It's the universe giving information again, so to speak. Oh, let's see, am I greedy? Well, that would be, okay, I can imagine having a lot of money. I can see that perspective. Yeah, I can see how I can feel into that. And that's it. And then it's done. And then you're no longer a person who's not greedy, or a person who's greedy. You don't have to be either one, or you could say both are possible.
Exactly, and it's what it's naturally meant to be. I don't know which. I remember there's some story of a Zen master. By the way, it's Ojin, Vancouver here. Hi guys. Of some Zen master who whatever attained enlightenment, and they all ran up to him and say, "Well, how is it now?" And he said, "Well, I'm as miserable and awful of a human as I was before." Right? And that's just what it is. Right?
Yeah.
And I love that. I love that so much when I, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know.
Yeah,
I
know
that,
yeah.
That's my form. I'm an asshole. Oh, well, or whatever, right? But there's no story behind it then, and it's, you know, it's.
I'll say one quick little thing. You know this pointer that we use sometimes, you know, that there is no one, or there's no one here. And like years ago, I had taken that pointer. I kind of misunderstood or misinterpreted what it really meant. You know, I had taken on the identity of someone who was no one. You know, that was my identity. I was no one. I was free. I was enlightened. I was no one. And you were still someone. You were still in the dream. You were still ignorant. Actually, I realize now that truly, what it truly means when to be no one is to be open to being anyone. You know, to truly be no one is to be open to take on any role. So I can, you know, to no longer for example, you know, years ago when I thought I was enlightened, you know, when my girlfriend would come up to me and say, Jeff, you know, you, something like, I don't know, you look a bit sad. And of course, because I thought I was enlightened or whatever, I couldn't admit that I was sad. I was saying, no, that's your projection.
Right.
You see, actually, I realize now that, of course, there was sadness. And she, because she loved me, you know, she was picking up on that. But I had stopped listening because I was trying to hold up this image of, you know, enlightened people aren't sad. Therefore, when you say you look sad, which is just you sharing, it's just her lovingly sharing something that she feels. She wasn't actually accusing me of being sad. She wasn't saying, Jeff, you are a sad person. What she was saying is, you know, oh, because I love you and I'm quite open to you, I see things in you, maybe other people don't. I see that you're there's a little bit of sadness at the moment, and that's okay. And she wasn't even saying there was a problem with it. You know, but because I was holding up this identity of, you know, enlightened people never get sad, never get angry, never get blah, 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 I couldn't hear it, and I stopped listening.
Yeah.
You know, to someone just sharing out of love, you know, and I mean, how, so it's a paradox, really, because, you know, I thought I was no one, and no one can get sad, right? If there's really no one, then there's no one that can get sad. And I was so mixed up in all that Advaita stuff. The point of there is no one, I mean, if it means anything, you know, to truly be no one is to be open to being anyone. To truly be no one is to have the space to be anyone. So, to be sad.
Yeah. And to say it.
And to say it, and to hear it.
Oh, and here's another question that Z asked. I thought segued nicely into that. Can you speak of the fundamental question whether a relationship between partners allows for or can be utilized to further spiritual insight, or at least when one first embarks on a spiritual path? What I would say is yes, but it wouldn't just be when you first embark. I mean, life is this. I mean, this is life. This is relationship, and it's always sort of. I mean, it's an ongoing exploration, isn't it? It's absolutely what we're talking about. Is that little opposites, these little shadows that pop up, you know, the dark side of this whole awakening thing. There is, just to use a kind of a catchphrase, the dark side, which means that awakening has a little bit of a curse to it, which is that it doesn't have to, but I've certainly seen it in myself, that with the recognition that there is no one, comes all these, who knows what kind of story to come up from that, and we've illuminated so many of them here. I mean, we've really, really illuminated, and there's so many more, like, that enlightened people have, they only have quiet minds, they never say anything, that they never think. Those are other shadows, and every time we do that, whatever we do with that, whatever image we hold on to, we basically shut out the other image, and the other image is a relationship, the other viewpoint, it's the other person, it's the other side of the coin. And so we find conflict everywhere, so we're really saying that relationship is spirituality. I mean, it really is, that's what we're saying. It's, you know, to use a phrase, we're waking up out of this. I mean, isn't that the whole point of all this? And then the amendment to this question was, is it possible that an intimate relationship and nurture spiritual growth, or should it be avoided, as was evident by monks, nuns throughout time, which created an environment with less distractions? You know, I mean, certainly that's somebody's path of celibacy. I have nothing to say about that. That's their path. I mean, I don't know whether that works for them. I can't say that ultimately. I just know that with anything, shadows can pop up, because if I believe is about, like, some formlessness where all sexual appetite is shut out, and that I hide myself away from the goings on of the world, then basically at some point there's going to be some kind of shadow element that pops up in that. If I think, for example, that somehow sex is bad, then I'm going to have that shadow. I'm going to think that enlightened people don't have sexual appetite. And so as soon as a sexual urge comes up or someone presents something, what is it showing me? The same thing. It's showing me what I've rejected about my experience, which is just sexual feelings. I mean, and so I guess on some path, to not have intimate relationships maybe works for a while, but with all kind of methods and tests, dark side, it has its potential shadow elements. So I would just say yes to that. Right.
Yeah, so maybe, Scott, we should talk about inseparability. Awareness, and concepts of awareness, and how that relates to relationship and intimacy and seeking as well. Maybe we should talk about seeking. And how that relates to relationship.
What we've been talking about that the whole time, because if I have a relationship with you and I believe that you are supposed to, you're supposed to listen to me, you're supposed to do something, you're supposed to give me something, you're supposed to change, you're supposed to respond a certain way, to praise me, to give me acknowledgement, attention, whatever it is, and I'm seeking something from you. I'm seeking, just like I was seeking enlightenment, or I'm seeking drugs, or seeking whatever. I'm still seeking because it comes from a sense of that something's missing. And when something's missing, obviously I'm going to look outside myself in some other, whether it's an object or a thing, to make that whole. I mean, I've had a life full of that. And it happens, certainly happens in relationship. But what happens, and I think that this is an important part of the thing, is seeing through the seeker. Mm-hmm. That there's not, you know, and just on the Advaita side of it, there is no one. And so therefore, when there's no one, nothing is missing. There's just awareness. All there is awareness, in the deepest sense, I guess you could say. And nothing is missing from awareness, because everything is appearing in awareness. Nothing's outside of it. I mean, even if I had a thought that something was missing, or that you're supposed to listen to me more, that thought is happening in awareness. It's not, it's all here. So then, what happens when the seeking in relationship, and of course we could just be very sort of radical non-dual, we could say seeking in relationship is also oneness, And that's true. There's a truth to that. And we can, that's like a perspective we can actually fully embrace.
In an ultimate sense, just quickly going to say about seeking, you know, and the different forms seeking takes, you know. I mean, seeking is basically, like you were saying, it's looking for something, you know, looking for something in the future to complete us, something that isn't here now. Essentially, you know, in the most simplest language, is looking for something that isn't here now to complete me one day. And it takes, you know, it can take the form of spiritual seeking. It could be the search for enlightenment. You know, one day I'll reach enlightenment and that will save me, that will complete me. Or, you know, it can be the search for love. It can be the search for one day I will discover unconditional love. And I need to use, you know, I'm going to find wholeness, because essentially the whole thing is the search for wholeness. You know, the seeking, you could say, is the search for wholeness. I'm going to find wholeness through another person. You know, you either find it in a guru or in a teaching, or you think you're going to find it in another person. So really it's the same thing as the spiritual seeking, you know, the search for enlightenment, the search for liberation, for awakening, and the search for, you know, the perfect relationship, the perfect lover, you know, the person who is going to complete you. It's essentially the same thing. Sorry, I just wanted to kind of add that.
No, I mean, I think that's basically what I said, back to the thing of the possibility of relationship, what we're talking about is the possibility. Well, what I was saying is that, yes, in an absolute sense, seeking in relationship is oneness, just as seeking for enlightenment is oneness, seeking enlightenment, mm-hmm. That's all true. I mean, there's a truth to that, that there's nothing that is not this, we can't possibly step mm-hmm. out of it, no matter what. But what would it be like? It's like a question. What would that be like now, right now, not as some future event? What is it possible now to not seek anything in relationship? And that's a different kind of a question. It's not just that there is nobody and no one, or that seeking is also oneness. It's just a question, and that's all.
Mm.
Doug Sandlin here again. It occurs to me that everything that's being discussed is about artificial fragmentation. For instance, the story with you and your mom, I thought that was a perfect example, that there was kind of this artificial conceptual division, and mm-hmm. seeking is that as well, feeling like a separate ego is that, feeling like our partner should do something, or et cetera, you know, all of that is this artificial fragmentation. And when that is absent in any present moment, there's just a natural harmonious flowing. For instance, if you're walking with your mom and she says, look, a beautiful tree, kind of the natural flowing of the moment would be to say, oh, yeah, you know, just to kind of participate in it without any concepts one way or the other. And by the way, I loved your A and B dialogue, and I didn't realize it came from a real story. I used to be B also. So, you know.
Oh, the A and B dialogue.
Yeah, and so I know that territory well also. But, you know, wholeness is reality. And but when we just let it be that way, you know, it all flows just fine.
Mm.
The way you said that was so simple, but it is that simple.
It is that simple. Oh, thank you.
Okay. Unless you have a comment, Jeff, I've got something in the email.
Well, I just want to talk a little bit about you know, the inseparability about this is the question, is there anything missing now? You know, is anything missing from awareness? You know, does awareness lack anything? Because what you'll find is that, you know, right now everything simply appears, you see, the sights, the sounds and the smells, feelings in the body. And what's missing?
Even if I had a thought that something is missing, that's happening.
Exactly. even the thought that something's missing isn't missing. There can't be anything missing from awareness, you know, and there's not too much stuff, and there's not too little stuff. it's like the perfect amount of stuff appearing in awareness, because awareness isn't at war with any of the stuff that appears in awareness. And this is just like a language we're using. You know, we're kind of distinguishing awareness from everything that appears in awareness. And I'm not saying that actually there is an awareness separate from contents of awareness, because in the end, you'll never find that division between awareness and everything that appears in awareness. So like you'll never find the division between awareness and a sound appearing. You know, so you could say in a sense that even a sound appearing in awareness is inseparable from awareness, and in a sense it is awareness. It's awareness appearing as a sound. See, so it's almost like there's this intimacy. There's you know, sometimes I talk about it as, well, it's love. You know, it's like awareness is in love with everything that appears in awareness, and in that there's no seeking. You know, that inseparability is, you could say, the end of seeking. Because
yeah, it's the end of division, and it is so much love, and it's the totality of all being and loving and being itself. So everything that appears as it or within it is just that. So there's nothing to divide against, and there's no tension there. And you know, so like this whole thing of not knowing and the breath that we feel when we don't know, it's through an identification with what needs to substantiate itself by what it is around itself. And when it no longer needs that, and that's no longer happening, and there's just this, there's just being this and relating with this as itself. And it's like, yeah, every sound, everything that would in some other life appear anomalous is just part of the perception. I had this most amazing experience on an airplane where there was this baby who was screaming behind me. And in the past, prior to this experience, I would have sent the baby energy and, you know, peace to try to quiet the baby down. And by some way, I was in a very peaceful, blissful place of awareness within myself. And by some grace, I just really heard this baby. It was a very, to my other ears, would have been very obnoxious, kind of angry screaming, very dissonant. But I really heard this baby, and it was like bliss going through my body. It was an ecstasy. It was practically orgasmic. And the baby stopped. And I turned around and looked at the baby, and the baby was looking in my direction. It was catacorned, like in the road behind me in the center, and I was on the left. And this thing happened 3 times in a row, and I never tried to use my... In fact, I wanted to hear it again, because it was so delicious. The sound was so amazing. And it was like, it was awareness hearing itself, and I think the baby really felt heard or something. I don't know. That's the story I'm making out of it. That's confabulation, I don't know. But nevertheless, from my perspective, I was just delighting in this baby. I was just loving this baby, not trying to get it to stop, not saying, poor baby, not saying, what's going on with the mother, what the baby is crying like that. You know, just loving so much what is. And so, like, when I see, you know, wholeness, so we're talking about wholeness, you know, and missing something, it's like wholeness moves towards itself. Wholeness just moves towards itself, and perhaps a deeper realization of itself. But it's like we create this duality with the multiplicity, with the many faces of the one, and it kind of creates a paradoxical bind within our experience, I think. You know, if we just kind of do a deductive logic or deductive reasoning or something, and go, okay, there's only one, or there's not, you know, how can there be a you and a me? But it's like, this is here. Here we are.
it's so beautiful, because there's not, you never find two things. You never find someone hearing a baby. What you'll find is the hearing and the baby crying are one and the same thing. There's not two movements. There's not a hearing movement and a baby crying movement. It's the same movement. You know, and that's intimacy, and that's love, and then you don't have to call it anything, because then, I mean, even that's too much in a way, you know, even to call it anything, just all there is that, you know, that beyond, yeah. Beyond words, beyond, you know, and it's right there. That's the beauty of it. It's right there.
Yeah.
Well, I was just going to say, you know, it's not something to be found at the end of a long search, because it's right there. It's there in the sound of the baby crying. You know, it's like how obvious does life have to make it that it's right here?
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's life gives you everything. Everything is there so this can be seen. It's there in the sound of a baby crying. It's in the sound of the, you know, it's in the roadworks and the feeling of pain and in rain falling down and in sound of cars. I mean, it's there in life as life. You know, it's like, it's not to be found at the end of a long search. It's actually right there in awareness, you know, as awareness, like right now. That's it's like the intimacy that everyone seems to be looking for in the future, you know, in time and in space, actually it's already there. And that's whatever it is.
Yeah.
What that is.
Yeah, exactly. What's interesting is that you can't really find it in a future, because then you're not, because we're not there in the future. We're here.
Exactly. The baby is crying now.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. Yeah, and that, you know, and it's like this thing, you know, we were talking about not knowing and death and... They can become stories too, and I think in a sense they're antecedents to this opening, you know, and being willing to let go of our preconceptions and so forth. But when you're in the experience, is it really so much not knowing? And we can step outside and see that story, but is it just this experiencing itself? And there's maybe a very clairvoyant knowing. Like, you know, my mother sometimes listens, she's talking with me, and she'll say things that are so amazingly brilliant. She says to me, "Ellen, there's no way I could have ever said that to you. There's nothing in my background that could have brought me to say this to you. I don't know what I'm talking about. I feel like I'm channeling you to you, you know?" And it's like there's this connection that we all have, and everything, this totality that just moves together and breathes together as one. And, you know, we can step outside of it and say, we kind of need it at some point maybe to say, "I don't know," because the knowing that we think we have is from the mind, but there's another kind of knowing beyond the mind, perhaps?
Yeah, I guess that's, you know, when I talk about not knowing, I think it's just words again, you know, it's not that I don't know. It's not that I don't know, because that again, of course, that would be a mental position, you know, that I don't know. I think that the not knowing I talk about is the knowing. You know, in that not knowing, everything is known. Because everything is absolutely there. It's like that in that not knowing, there is that baby, the obviousness of that and the knowing of that. But it's not the knowing of the mind, you see. So I guess it's just words again, you know, knowing, not knowing, knowing, not knowing, but...
I'm sure that you know that. I feel that when I read your words, and I feel that from you. I know that that's very clear to you. I just felt the need to say that here because of the emphasis that we've been making on not knowing and death, which is another story.
I mean, you can weave a story around anything, can't you? It's amazing, you know. Like no matter what words you use, when you're trying to talk about this, the mind could latch onto any of those words and start to weave a new story around those words. So it's, we probably should have, Scott. Did we say at the beginning that? Normally we'll say at the beginning that, you know, it's not about the words and you know, the words are just pointers, so, but yeah, I mean, you're absolutely right, it's, you could make a story out of anything, you know. Whereas really, what we're really trying to point to is beyond all of the stories. But at the same time, it's not a rejection of the stories, because that's different. It's a kind of a seeing, you know, seeing through rather than a pushing away. Because there's no one there pushing the stories away, because that would be another story, is pushing away a story.
And another position, you know, surviving against the story.
Yeah, mm-hmm. and that's what I was talking about before, you know, with the story about my mum, you know, because, you know, she had the story about the beautiful tree. So what I was doing back then was pushing away her story of the beautiful tree, because my story was that there was no stories, you know. So it's you just really start to appreciate this thing called mind. You know, it's astonishingly creative, the ways in which it can create division. Well, actually, there is no division, but it can give the illusion of there being some division, and it can actually believe in that division. And it's astonishingly creative in the ways it can divide. You know, it's really quite incredible.
Thank you so much. I'll put myself on Starships again. Nice talking directly with you.
Me too. Lots of love.
Yeah. Yes, Doug here again. I just wanted to mention there's a sutra in the Shiva Sutras that says simply, knowledge is bondage. And that's counterintuitive for a lot of us, but I think it's a very interesting pointer that when we make a fixed set of knowledge as something that we have, and it kind of creates this separate sense of self or whatever, that is indeed bondage. And when that's not there, when there's just more of a free flowing, there's a knowing that's kind of, you know, it's real, it's harmonious, it fits with whatever's going on. And I just thought that was an interesting distinction because, you know, knowing and not knowing has kind of become a theme of this call, it seems like. And I thought that was interesting that knowledge is bondage.
Yeah, and when there's no longer the bondage, there's just, hey, will you mow the grass?
yeah, there could be like a knowing that kind of comes up as Adya Shanti actually has a line where he says, I know what I need to know when I need to know it.
Yeah,
you know, and it's kind of like that. It just comes up as we need it from whatever the field of awareness, you know, could be called, you know.
I think you're right. And you and the last caller and Jeff were kind of hitting on something, which is that, you know, we talk about concepts and everything because, you know, most of us come to this spiritual path, or whether you call it a spiritual path or whatever, believing that everything that we're saying is essentially true, and that we, you know, out with all these positions, and that you can have that moment where you sort of see, yeah, they're all stories, and you know what they are, that they really are, and isn't that wonderful, the fact that we can have stories, because as I was listening to the dialogue between the lady and Jeff, thinking about how wonderful it is that can actually happen, and thinking about what else is there. I mean, there's life, but life moves through our stories. It moves through our stories, and when you see that it's not really what we thought it was, then it can just move. And here we are just telling a bunch of stories today. That's all we're doing. And it's really quite innocent. It's actually totally innocent. There's no bondage there when you see that that's what it is. And in some ways, you know, in the beginning of my own spiritual path, it was about seeing that all concepts are just, you know, they're just concepts. And that felt so true. There was a moment then, though, when somebody started to speak, and I thought, that's brilliant, actually, that can actually happen, that something can appear, because it didn't have the same weight to it before. You know, it wasn't like, oh, it wasn't about truth or even identity. It was just like, oh, there's a story happening, and that's all it is. And that's why it's like that's another division that gets broken down, I think, or it can. Jeff said that to me in London. He said, you know, he was just like, but life moves through our concepts. I mean, how else do I tell you how beautiful it was when I went to the ocean and I say the waves were doing this and there were people on the beach and there was this long parade of people of all walks of life, black, white, gay, straight, men, women, and they were all like the reggae singers. How can I tell you how life moved if I don't have concepts to tell you my story? You know, it's brilliant.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's like concept and story and multiplicity is, you know, it's clearly happening. It's just when we think that that's all there is, you know, when we think there's only, that multiplicity means separation. Obviously, that's where all the trouble is, you know? all the discomfort is. You articulate that very well, by the way, in Love's Quiet Revolution. I mean, I was just reading that this morning. Like, you say some of those things very clearly as far as just, like, not walking down around thought and memory. You know, and just, like, if we're just here in this moment, it's not so much that it's about everything being one or not one or can there be a relationship or not. It's more that things like that just don't apply in the actual moment. You know, in the actual moment, it's just what's going on, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Simple. Back to simple, yeah. Right? Mm-hmm. Anyway, there's it's not really a question. She was just making points that, she said, I don't know, quote, I don't know creates an opening in the possibility of true intimacy. She says, let's see, she says, non-dual does not mean not dual. It includes the dual, which is kind of the theme of all this, is that, you know, these become mental positions, you know, it's like, non-dual is great until you believe it, and then once you believe it, then it becomes your new division, and then it shuts out everything, and it becomes this other, becomes this belief system. I think that's what's being illuminated in these kinds of conversations, you know. Mm. And then here's another one. Oh, go ahead, Jeff.
Well, yeah, I mean, this is why this word non-duality, it's a funny old word, isn't it? Because, you know, non-duality, not two. Well, that's, I mean, of course, it's a completely dualistic concept. You're saying it's not duality. You know, you're pushing out literally the world. You're saying, I mean, if you take the word non-duality to literally mean not duality, then you, in a way, you've pushed out the entire world, because the world is duality, and thought is duality. With no duality, no me, you, left, right, up, down, past, future, there is no world. You know, and then there really is no possibility of talking. I mean, like, you know, of sharing, you know, it's a beautiful tree, or, you know, what did your day, you know, what was your day like yesterday? It's not even possible without language, thought, words, which are in the world of two, which are in the world of past, future, me, you, right, wrong, left, right, up, down. So it's like no duality, no world, no communication, no relationship. You could so easily go down that path, you know.
Yes.
So this is why it's a funny old word. I don't know if I want to use it anymore, really, this word non-duality, because non-duality, it doesn't mean, it can't mean not duality, you know, it's because it's also duality, you know, I mean, because in the end, you have no way of separating non-duality from duality, that it's like non-duality appearing as duality, and duality is the appearance of non-duality, so then you can't even call it non-duality, you know, and then
it's life.
It's just life, I mean, and that's really, that's what we're talking about, isn't it, in the end? We're talking about life. We're talking about life and what happens in life. You know, the stuff that happens in life and duality, non-duality, duality, non-duality. In the end, it's just another pair of conceptual opposites. You know, what's even beyond duality? So you never find that division in your direct experience of life. Where do you ever find the division between duality and non-duality? How could you ever say, oh, that's dualistic and that's non-dualistic? How could you ever point at anything and say, that's non-dual, that's dual?
Yes, it's all within the same language.
Amazing.
Hey, I wanted to share something. I want to share something with the callers, because this is also something that you brought up when we were talking in London. And Deb, who I know through email conversations, wrote something very simply that carries so much wisdom, and I think it's a good way to talk about what you were saying in London, which is, she said, hi, Scott, here's a comment or a question. She said, and yet, in the obviousness and the openness of what is there is movement towards one particular person or one particular ice cream flavor. And there's so much, it seems so simple, but what she's saying, though, is that, you know, when, in seeing that there's nothing to seek in a relationship, and there's nobody to change, and it's just, and you could say that there is no one, or however you experience that, it's just awareness or whatever, then that actually, you know, it doesn't have to be about a denial of all wants, a denial of all views and all voices. And you were mentioning, Jeff, there can be like, and this is, you know, of course the mind can get a hold of this next phrase and run with it, but there can be like an authentic have this, I'm going to be mad, or I'm going to be, or I'm going to lack something, or you must give this to me. It's just a simple movement towards something that says, you called it the authentic voice. Because if you deconstruct everything that you have to say and think in a relationship, then there's no way to want or control, or if you believe that there's nothing, that everything that comes up in your mind is just a false perception and it has to go down, well, that's fine, I guess, as a practice for a while, but with that, it has its limits. Because at some point, you can say something, and it's very simple and authentic. It just says, I'd like to spend time with you today. Do something like that. It doesn't have to be about seeking. It doesn't have to be, if you don't do this, I don't love you. If you don't, it's not about that. It's just, I'd like to spend time with you today. I'd like to have this ice cream flavor. And that's, again, something never talked about that I know of, at least in Advaita. The possibility of something like that is different than, you know, like I say, the old way. The old way is, give me this. I demand this. If you don't give me this, I'm not okay. Etc.
Yeah, and that's because you can so easily go down that route of, you know, deconstructing every single thought, every single viewpoint that appears in awareness, and until you really, truly don't want anything. You don't even like anything. You don't even prefer anything, because even a preference, you could say, even a preference for, say, coffee over tea. Or you could say, well, isn't that a concept as well? That, you know, that couldn't possibly be true, ultimately, that I prefer coffee. So you could deconstruct that, and so you just end up by kind of, you know, even, you could say, well, I prefer to get out of bed in the morning. You could say, well, that's a concept. I prefer to get out of bed. You could deconstruct that. You could end up lying in bed, you know, and all day. But that's where this all gets a bit tricky to talk about, doesn't it? Because you know, when there's no seeking, it doesn't mean that you lie in bed all day doing nothing. You know, what, in a way, at the end of seeking, what's left is, it's not detachment, and it's not kind of a closed offness from life. In a way, the end of seeking is the beginning of authentic living, you could say, the beginning of, like, the beginning of fascination with life. So it's very mysterious. It really is very mysterious, because you would have thought that when it's discovered that, you know, that life is complete, that what you are is already complete, that awareness is already inseparable from everything that appears in awareness, that nothing is missing, you know, that there's nothing to find, everything's here. You would have thought that once that was discovered, that life would somehow stop. And the beauty is that what I find anyway is that it doesn't stop, it goes on. And you know, the end of seeking, it's not the end of living. You know, it's in a way it's the beginning of living, the beginning of really living, it's the beginning of fascination with this life, with this, you could say, this embodied experience. What does it mean to wake up in the morning in this body? Well, not even in this body, just as this body, or whatever. I mean, even that doesn't matter anymore. You know, am I the body, am I not the body? That question isn't even there. And you wake up in the morning, oh, I feel like having coffee for breakfast. Coffee and a piece of toast. Where does that come from? I don't know. But what I find is that I find myself moving to have a cup of coffee and a piece of toast because I like it, you know, because it's tasty. And the thing is, you see, if I didn't get the coffee and toast, that would be okay. But what I find is that there's still likes, and there's still preferences, and there's still, you know, certain people I really enjoy hanging out with, and there's other people that I don't enjoy so much, and there's I like certain movies, I like certain songs, and like, that's part of the real richness of life, and that's part of the real richness of being alive and being here and exploring this, whatever this is, you know, this, because it's all a mystery to me, really. Whatever this is, this manifestation, this so-called world, but yeah, even if ultimately it's all a dream, somehow that doesn't matter, because you wake up in the morning and you have a cup of coffee, and that's the miracle. You know, and you can deconstruct all of that. Everything I've just said, you could totally deconstruct. You say, oh, it's all a concept. And of course it's all a body concept. You know, of course all of these are just concepts, but It's just what you said, Scott. You know, there is, at the end of seeking, there is still this authentic voice which says, yeah, I'd like a cup of coffee, or yeah, I'd love to hang out with you today, or yeah, I really enjoy your company, you know, and there's something really real about that, and authentic, and it's not a delusion.
Hello, I'm back. Can you hear me?
Back.
I wanted to say that I think we're about to see a distinction, a clarity of distinction here, or where I am seeing a clarity of distinction here is in speaking for what we think they're not, as opposed to just discovering and moving towards your truth, moving towards its greater realization and life, reading yourself in time. I mean, these are all things that we can, you know, look at through the eyes of all that seeking. That if we know that what is moving in life is itself, towards itself, then I don't see it an issue, you know, with seeking. I think that it creates suffering, and I think it creates division, that I think it's just life. But when we believe that what we're seeking for is other than what we are, then we end up reinforcing the separation from that with the seeking. So, I mean, again, it creates a paradoxical bind in the experience of the so-called seeker to stop, you know. And it's so important to learn to feel that place of just stopping, where that will that needs to constantly validate its existence simply rests. But at the same time, life moves, you know. We move and we get inspired and we learn and we grow. We, all of us here, are discovering and you know, and really looking. So what is that? Is that seeking? Or, you know, so there's a kind of a pejorative, you know, or a negative way that we can be seeking. And there's a very beautiful part of life that just moves towards own ever deepening realization.
So moves towards itself. I like the way you said that.
Mm. Thank you.
Yeah. Another thing I was going to share is that, you know, it's all relationship. For example, we have a little puppy here that almost died this week, had a bacterial infection. We've had the puppy for about 6 months, and, you know, if I were to say that that the puppy is just the concept, that without awareness there can't be a puppy, that the fur and the, you can deconstruct it completely, the fur is just a sensation, the name Gilly is just a thought that's appearing and disappearing, that without awareness there can't be a dog, and the dog is inseparable from awareness, and that death isn't real, so why worry about that? If the dog passes, it doesn't matter, because, you know, there is no world and there's no dog. And all of that's true, actually, because that's what freed me from, like, suffering through the whole thing. But in the end, there was just a little voice that said, I hope this dog survives.
Mm.
That's all. Just that simple. I hope I can hold my dog's face in my hand and give it another kiss, and that's it. It was just that simple. It was no invite in any of that. It had nothing to do. It was just more about love. It was something that I can't even understand. But it felt completely authentic, and it was also a knowing that if the dog passes, that's fine too, because the idea of having control over that, you know, it ultimately is ridiculous. But we're talking about something that we can't understand, that we can't know. It really is a mystery. But I like that when you say life moving towards itself, because that's a good way of saying it. It's moving towards itself. I want the dog to survive. Wouldn't that be nice if the dog survived? You'd have a couple years with the dog, and that was just that simple. It wasn't like there's no dog, there's no person, and all of my reactions towards this are just happening in awareness, so therefore it's all impersonal consciousness.
And you're not saying that, you know, I if the dog dies, I won't be complete.
Right.
But it's almost like you're saying, you know, this life is complete, this is complete, and I'd really love my beloved dog to stay alive. And that, somehow that's part of the completeness, you know, that's that's embraced by the completeness, the wanting the beloved dog to stay alive. And it's not that or completeness. Is it that is the completeness? And you know, and then the dog dies or the dog doesn't die, and it's all complete either way. But still, you know, you love your dog, and it's like, yes, it's complete, and it's complete. Life is complete. What I am is already whole, and I love my dog, and you know, I don't really want it to die. And to me, there's no contradiction there whatsoever. There is no paradox. There is no contradiction. There is no paradox.
There's only paradox to holistic thinking. It's all included. I mean, undivided awareness informs different thoughts and reactions and actions in life, you know, than a divided awareness. You know, and it could be that undivided awareness will have a very different response and thought had towards the dog, even though, you know, another expression of undivided awareness. In another space, we have, you know, for example, me from here. Because that's not my, you know, that's not what's calling for me here. But at the same time, you know, it's in connection with all and one with all, being one with all, that's the way we breathe, you know, in some diversity, and yet at the same time in unity. And there is no contradiction. It doesn't mean it's dualistic. I think the thing about dualism and that name, that word is a pointer, is just to be able to illuminate where we divide against what is, or we divide against reality. And not necessarily to point to the multiplicity of life and the diversity of life and life's experiences. And when we don't divide, then we're informed by a different kind of heartbeat, you know? And it doesn't mean non-action. It doesn't mean non-action.
That's beautiful. And with that note, I think we'll end it. We're about at the two-hour mark. So thank you very much for all that, and thanks to everybody. And maybe by having these kind of conversations, you know, it's like, it's just great because it starts other conversations, and to the extent that this kind of thing hasn't been talked about, well, now we can talk about it, you know.
So. Namaste. And thank you so much to everyone who called in today.
Yes.
And I'm sure this is a conversation we've just begun, and we'll be continuing with it. You know, continuing it. I can't even say the word continuing anymore. Continuing. We'll be continuing this conversation. We'll see where it goes.
Yep. Bye, everyone.
Bye, everybody.